schedules for the rest of the this year until January. So pick up one. Our treasurer, David Drum, has them there at the table. And which reminds me, we are a nonprofit organization, but we do have expenses, so we charge for coming to hear our lectures, $5, which is minimal, and for students, $2. So if you pay too much, we'll give you your money back. So if you're a full-time student, $2. So those who haven't paid, David, hold your hand up. There you go. He's the man with the money. Also, make sure you take care of your bill before you go. We don't like to be stuck with unpaid bills. And take care of your server, okay? Let's see. What else, David?
Talk about next week, I guess.
Oh, yes. We're going to talk about some future lectures. October the 11th, which is the next one, is Against Statutes of Limitation, John Harris. October 25th, Growing a New Generation of Social Justice Activists and Agitators, Tom Perryman. November the 8th, this is one that really I like. Are the size and age of the universe evidence against the existence of God? Sloan Lee. November 22nd, Minds, Machines, and Morality, Ethical Realms of Artificial Intelligence. December 13th, Religion and the Process. And I guess that'll take us to the end of the year. So pick up a schedule and welcome back over and over for some good philosophy. And we don't discuss just philosophy. This organization has been going on for 40 plus years, something like that. Science, art, history, all kinds of things. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Philip Rosemann, who was born in Frankfurt, Germany. He attended the University of Hamburg, was a research fellow in London at the Warburg Institute. He received his MA from Queen's University of Belfast, Northern Ireland, and his doctorate from the University of Louvain, Belgium. You might say he's a European. Been all over. He taught in Belgium for a year before moving to Uganda, where he taught at a new university that was developed there for a year, 1 or 2 years, 2 years. And after that, according to him, he settled down, or was less stressful anyway, at the University of Dallas, here in Dallas. Where he's been since 1997 as a professor of philosophy. Dr. Rosemann's main interests are medieval and contemporary thought, and he thinks that there are similarities between pre-modern and modern and post-modern, whatever post-modern means, culture, and I agree with him. Also, willkommen, Herr Professor Rosemann.
Yeah,
absolutely. Aburto Dallas Philosophers Forum, whose talk is entitled In Defense of Plagiarism. And I got to practice a little German, too.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Erkek, for this very kind introduction. And thank you for coming and spending an evening listening to abstruse philosophical ideas. In defense of plagiarism, I don't know how provocative that sounds here. In a university or in a college setting, it's very, very provocative, because there is an enormous amount of discussion these days among professors about the assumed amount of plagiarism that occurs among the students. Assumed because, well, I tend to think that at the institution where I'm teaching it, it's not actually all that bad. It's often professors who project suspicions of plagiarism into their students rather than the students actually plagiarizing. But anyway, so in defense of plagiarism, what could one say in defense of plagiarism? So first of all, in order to be a little bit more precise, let's try to define what plagiarism is so that we know what we're talking about. Otherwise, the whole thing is so vague. So I think plagiarism could be defined as an inexcusable theft of someone else's intellectual property, an act of deception, and perhaps it manifests a certain degree of disrespect towards the person who is the object of his plagiarism, who is made to believe that you wrote something that you didn't actually write. As you can see, the definition comes pretty much right now from a limited setting, from the setting of the classroom. So here's a student who submits an essay, and I see immediately that it's a plagiarized essay. How does one see it, by the way, that an essay is plagiarized? It's usually extremely easy. A student who has been making C's, C minus, C plus, B minus, suddenly submits an essay that is written in the most beautiful 19th century British English. The student somehow thinks that we don't notice that. So, but at any rate, so, but let me question some of the assumptions that are here. So it's a theft of someone else's intellectual property, so the student copied the ideas of some British authors from the 19th century and pretended that the ideas were his or her own. An act of deception, certainly the student turns the essay in. I'm reading the essay and I'm, you know, the idea is that I don't realize that the essay is actually by someone else. And perhaps it's even disrespectful, well, towards me as the instructor, perhaps, I mean, I'm difficult to offend. Perhaps towards the subject matter. You know, you should be taking your subject matter a little bit more seriously and not plagiarized. Okay, so that's a basic definition, which I could back up by a quotation from the Oxford English Dictionary. Especially since I'm not a native speaker, I always like to be very precise and look up stuff so that I really know the words that I'm using. OED, Oxford English Dictionary, the practice of taking someone else's works or ideas and passing them off as one's own. Always interesting when you look at a word, it's not only the meaning of the word, but when it first appeared. The word plagiarism was first, the first evidence for the use of the word plagiarism is in the year 1621. So you can ask yourself, so interesting, 1621, so before 1621 plagiarism didn't exist, or no one talked about it, or there was a different word for it. So it's always interesting. There are some people here who know German. I think it is a minority, but the minority that counts. One German poet has a line which is, so lernt ich traurig den Verzicht, kein Ding sei, wo das Wort gebricht. So I learned sadly to renounce, there is no thing where the word is lacking. There's no thing where the word is lacking, the German poet is. Stefan George is saying there. So if the word plagiarism is lacking, was the thing not in existence? Anyway. Many English words have Latin origins, as you know, the English language, you know, that confluence. Or so. What does plagiarism, where does it come from in Latin? Well, a plaga is a trap or a snare. And the plagiarius was and it existed, so it's kind of interesting. A literary thief, a kidnapper of words. The Roman poet Martial used this word in the first century. So, what is a plagiaria, feminine? A prostitute. A prostitute. So the plagiarius is the literary thief. The plagiaria is the person who ensnares someone who doesn't belong to her. Right. So, but it's not, all these meanings are not so good. So, so there was criticism of plagiarism, even in antiquity. I just mentioned the poet Marcia in the first century, who says, you are plagiarius, so you've kidnapped words from someone else and now you're putting them in your poem. And this criticism seems to have existed. To what extent, I don't know. I haven't, you know, conducted an in-depth study of plagiarism in classical antiquity, but it existed. Despite the fact that classical poets were very much convinced that the poetry that they produced did ultimately not come from them. You know, of course, the classical talk about the muses. The muses. It was typical, it was standard for an ancient poet to invoke the muses at the beginning of the poem that was being composed. Homer begins, Andramoi enepe musa, invoking the muses at the beginning of the Odyssey. Your philosophers, or at any rate, hobby philosophers, Socrates, at one important point in the Dialogue Symposium, gets all the essential insights regarding the nature of love from a goddess. So that all that he does is reporting what the goddess told him. So in other words, the words are not his. And he's not embarrassed or ashamed about that. I mean, rather, he is a messenger of the gods. Similarly, when Homer, or whoever, you know, composed this set of poems, invokes the muses, that doesn't mean, oh, disregard this poem, this is all unimportant and plagiarized. It's rather, look, I'm a divine messenger who is giving you this poetry here. It's not coming from me. So that's not negative at all. So the question now is this notion of inspired speaking, the words don't come from me, they're not really mine, is that utterly out of date? We would say, you know, the ancients, okay, they were polytheists and they lived in this like crazy universe and so we've moved so far beyond that. I think that contemporary poets and artists still often have a sense that anything that they're producing that is genuinely of value comes from somewhere else, from some higher up instance. And that doesn't have to be a Christian god. Some poems of contemporary artists are not theists, but they would say, where does this painting come from? Oh, it came to me as I was sitting there in the landscape, etc., etc. And that doesn't mean I plagiarized it. Or it means I'm speaking, I'm expressing something that transcends who I am. But that's not a bad thing. Evidence for this sense, even among contemporary poets, that what they're saying comes from somewhere else, somewhere higher than them, evidence of that is found in much of contemporary poetry. Some of you may remember that a year or two ago I gave a talk here on the contemporary poet Leonard Cohen. Although I spoke with a member of the group who said he had no recollection of this at all, which I think means that it can't have been all that memorable. So I'll try to do better this evening. But Leonard Cohen, in one of his poems, about which I talked a couple of years ago, about which I've written a little article, that's why I know it so well, talks about the way in which he receives his poetry. The poem is called Going Home. I love to speak with Leonard. He's a sportsman and a shepherd. He's a lazy bastard living in a suit. But he does say what I tell him, even though it isn't welcome. He just doesn't have the freedom to refuse. He will speak these words of wisdom like a sage, a man of vision, though he knows he's really nothing but the brief elaboration of a tube. He wants to write a love song, an anthem of forgiving, a manual for living with defeat, a cry above the suffering, a sacrifice recovering. But that isn't what I need him to complete. I want him to be certain that he doesn't have a burden, that he doesn't need a vision, that he only has permission to do my instant bidding, which is to say what I have told him to repeat. Who do you think is the speaker in this poem?
The muse.
Or God.
Okay.
The muse or God. He doesn't need a vision, he doesn't have a burden. He only has permission to say what I have told him to repeat. And Leonard Cohen is a funny man, a very strange man in many ways, but he's also a very serious poet. He takes his poetry incredibly seriously. And so he seems to have this sense that the words come from some kind of beyond. So, To return to the question of, well, I'm still talking about the question of plagiarism, so we have a different conception here of what an author is. The idea of plagiarism presupposes that an author produces some original ideas which belong to that author and are protected by some kind of copyright. What we learned now from Cohen is that he seems to be of the opinion that the author really is someone else's voice. The author is a mouthpiece for ideas or words that he or she certainly doesn't own. So we have two different conceptions here. The poetic conception is, interestingly enough, also the religious conception of speech. They're very similar. If you are Christian, or if you're a Muslim, by the way, or a Jew, you have a body of writings that you believe are inspired by God. The assumption here is, you know, of course there's biblical scholarship, and everyone knows that, for example, well, some of the Pauline epistles aren't actually by Paul. The letter to the Hebrews is not really by Paul. Whoever it was by, it was, so people who believe in Scripture, someone who didn't simply put down some of his own thoughts, but someone who whose ideas came from a higher place. So it's kind of interesting, this artistic conception, which doesn't have to be religious. Cohen is quite a religious Jew. But I don't think that really matters. I think other poets, other artists would agree with that conception. It comes together with, or is very similar to, a religious conception of speech, of words. So the religious and artistic conception is that it's not us who own the words, but the words own us. Again, I want to make sure that I don't come across as overly theological here. My colleagues always criticize me. I teach in a philosophy department at a Catholic university. I'm sorry, I mean, I'm supposed to say religious things. But still, I mean, it's gotten to the point where in department meetings, colleagues will say, Philip, this is not a theology department. I'd say, oh, sorry. shut up because I said something too religious again. But in order to make sure that I don't come across here as some kind of guy who wants to give a homily, to illustrate this point, words own us rather than our owning the words and having copyright and so on and so forth. So that is clearly a religious idea, but it's also a Greek idea. Don't know if anyone of you has had an opportunity to look at the writings of one of the very first philosophers, the Greek Heraclitus, who composed, it's also interesting, a poem. So this philosopher is at the same time a poet. So, and in that poem, Heraclitus, it's not completely clear what he's saying, as is often the case with philosophers. We don't exactly know what he's trying to say. But if you look at it very carefully and in the light of secondary literature, he seems to be saying that logos and cosmos, that words and world, by the way, in English it's also nice, words and world are inextricably intertwined. So we usually think there's a world out there, and then I come and say stuff about it. That is to say, here you have a table, and then I come and I attach a label table to it. But what if the relationship between words and world were much more integrated? Yes. If there were a much closer connection between the two. That's certainly what Heraclitus thought. That's also what's implicit in this idea according to which God speaks reality into existence. Have you heard a quotation which runs like this? Some of you may. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by Him. How can one make stuff with a word? I can speak, but that doesn't make things. In the 20th century, there was an interesting British philosopher by the name of J.L. Austin, who was not religious at all, by the way. How sad for Austin. But in any case, Austin wrote a book entitled How to Do Things with Words. This book contains a theory of the so-called performative speech acts. A performative speech act is a speech act that does things with words, such as, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife. So there are two people standing in front of me, and if I'm in the appropriate position, by the way, if I'm just a philosophy professor saying, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife, that gives rise to laughter, I guess, because it's kind of interesting. The right person has to say it. Okay? But if I'm a judge of the peace, or a priest, of course, or whatever, and I say, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife, the two people are husband and wife. It's kind of interesting. Similarly, if I'm a judge, and I say, I hereby sentence you to a imprisonment for natural life. The person is imprisoned for natural life. All it takes is the judge saying this. Or perhaps writing it on a piece of paper and signing, which is not fundamentally different. We need the document is simply a record of what was said in the courtroom. Well, the author of Genesis and of the Gospel according to John, let there be light, that's Genesis according to John, as in the beginning was the Word, seems to have imagined God as this performative speaker. So, you know, the judge can say, I hereby sentence you to, you know, life imprisonment, and so on and so forth. Or, you know, Queen Elizabeth can say, that's, by the way, J.L. Austin's example, which shows you how British it is. The Queen steps in front of a ship and says, oh, I hereby christen you the Elizabeth II. And the ship sails off and is called the Elizabeth II. So, but what if there were a God who can say, not I christen you the Elizabeth II, or, but who would simply say, let there be stuff.
Let there be stuff.
Stuff. A reality, world, things. And they are things. Now, obviously there's no proof for that. Because you see, scripture is best read as a piece of poetry. Which doesn't mean, by the way, that it's nonsense. But it's best read as a piece of poetry. So, for example, you know, those people who look at Genesis and then are trying to find where 3,000 or 6,000 years ago, you know, Adam and Eve lived. There's a slight mistake going on here. That's not how it was meant to be read, which on the other hand also doesn't mean it's nonsense. It just has to be read according to a different register. The register could well be a poetic one, which, again, poetry could be very true. Not in the sense in which natural science is true, but still. So, then we have a conception already of language and of words and of the relationship of human beings to these words, which is very different from what I said initially about plagiarism. Again, if we accuse someone of plagiarism, we assume that words, ideas, etc., belonging to someone else were stolen. But what if no word really belonged to us? If it all came from some other speaker, who spoke at the very beginning, and all we're trying to do is stammer after him, then we're all plagiarists. So, let me continue for 1 second with that medieval stuff about which I'm talking right now. Have you heard the expression book of nature? I don't think it makes very much sense anymore in the contemporary world. But the medievals thought that God was the author of the book of nature. And again, you see a very interesting idea here. God is a poet. God is an author. And God writes the book of nature. What does that mean? What does God write with, by the way? Like his thumb? Not really. God writes with things. We write with a pen and with words. God writes with things. God makes a tree, and that's God's word that he puts there so that we read the tree correctly and see God in it. Or God writes a human being and wants us to see through that human being to God. That's what this whole idea of made the image and likeness of God means. It means look at a fellow human being and don't see the human being there, but see rather something divine in that human being. There's something more going on. And that's, if you will, a kind of divine poetry that's occurring there. So, if we read the book of nature correctly, we read God's poem, and we see God as the author there. And again, I think that's not only a religious sentiment, but an artistic one. You know, a painter looks at a landscape and will not see there a certain geological formation. The scientist looks at a landscape and sees a geological formation. For example, I love traveling to West Texas, you know, the Big Bend and so forth, and geologically it becomes very, very interesting there. So you can look at it with the eyes of the geologist and see, you know, the strata of I'm not a geologist, so I have to make this up, of seas that once, you know, were up to here, that they receded, and now we have the fossils, blah, blah, blah. Or you can look at it with the eyes of a poet or a religious person and see a beauty that points beyond itself to something more. That's what I mean by saying reading the Book of Nature. To continue with that for just a second, in this worldview, according to which God is a speaker who speaks that poem into existence, which is the world, what's the role there for the human being? The role is to read. We have to be readers of reality. What if we make stuff? Because, you know, in this worldview, the medieval worldview, people realized that sometimes human beings didn't just read reality. They sat there and said, oh, this is all wonderful creation, let me take this in. But sometimes they became original, made stuff. There's a saying, though, and since our friends from the Dallas Philosophers Forum were so kind to give me this whiteboard that I requested, it would be cruel not to be using it. So therefore, I'm going to use the whiteboard, try not to fall over these various cables here. There was a saying, and now I'm going to demonstrate the depth of my learning. I'm going to write down a Latin sentence. The Latin sentence is, can you even read it? Because, ans imitatur natura. This means, art imitates nature. It was the principle on the basis of which medieval thinkers were trying to understand what we do as human beings when we become creative. Art imitates nature. And art is anything that we make, not just the painting. You know the expression an artifact. You have the word art in there, interestingly enough. So a chair is a piece of art in that conception. Okay? Art imitates nature. So in that view, what is a house? An elaborate cave. So in other words, we looked at the environment in which we live. We discovered that it's kind of nice in a cave where it's, you know, snowy out there. The weather is not so fine. So we had to do a cave, like the hobbits in J.R.R. Tolkien. You know, the hobbits live in these caves. And then as we developed as a human race, we found that we could do better than cave. And initially, I don't know, even in France, my mother lives close to the French border, there is still now, the houses are now empty though, a village that started as houses that were built out of caves. So you go into these houses, and you have walls and windows and so forth, but as you go in there, you can see that the back of the house is cave. It's kind of interesting. What is a car? A very advanced horse. It really is. I mean, if you look at it, I don't know how it sounds to you, perhaps it sounds ridiculous, which is fine. It really is. As a philosopher, you have to run that risk occasionally. And it's also fun to, you know, amuse people. So, look, what is a car? It has these four wheels, right? That's 4 feet. Then a car has a face, which is either friendly or angry. You know, as the charger comes up behind me, you know, 5 inches behind me, the face looks angry. And I try to get out of the way, you know, before I... other cars, deliberately, have friendly faces. What are clothes? Art imitates nature. Well, we've lost too much of our fur. So in the winter, it can get kind of cold if we're naked. So therefore, this stuff. Art imitates nature. So if you believe in that principle that limits technological progress, it limits it. Not absolutely, but it's limits. It limits it. You cannot go beyond a certain point of creativity. If you say, I no longer know how this is a copy of nature, extends nature, you can't make it. It's not even conceptually possible anymore. An interesting aspect about modern civilization is, because you see, in this conception, there is no originality in human making. What is a house? It's a cave. A cave was there. What is a car? It's an advanced horse. Horse power, by the way. Horse power. The horse was there, so we were kind of, you know, cool and bright in our heads that we're capable of making a car, but we didn't. What we did is we took a horse and thought about how a horse functions and replaced the horse's heart with a V6 and blah, blah, blah. You get the point. There's no real originality there. In the modern industrialized world, You could reverse this. You could say instead of ars imitatur naturam, you could say natura imitatur artem. Nature imitates art. That's a Heideggerian point. The German philosopher Martin Heidegger, who's one of the strongest points, is critique of technology. He will say, what is a river? And he will answer, a source of electricity. You dam it up, you know, and then you make it into electricity. Or Heidegger has this essay where he has somebody walking through a forest, and it's kind of gloomy. He will say, what does the person walking through the forest see in the forest? Potential lumber. That's kind of crazy, but it's true. And I think that's probably how we look at the world that surrounds us. The world that surrounds us is either a resource for something that we want to make, or it's in the way of something that we want to make. And we have bent reality to our designs instead of subjecting ourselves to reality. Those of you who know a little bit more about philosophy can associate what I'm just saying with the ideas of Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant is the German philosopher who brought about what he himself calls a Copernican revolution. He said that it's not the world that we take in order to understand, but we rather project our ideas onto the world. And the world as it is in itself is something that we can't even know. Philosophers discuss whether Kant is right or wrong. In some way, that's a silly discussion, because that's how we live. So it's not a question of whether Kant is theoretically right or wrong. One way to read Kant is simply to say, he's describing how we're living. We're imposing human structures onto the world. So what, you know, what's the discussion about the theory? It's just true. So, something interesting happens as we conceive of the world as something that is subject to us, that we manipulate. This will begin to happen to us too. I hope that the idea is not now becoming a little bit too abstruse. See, in modernity, the dream is that we master the world in which we live. The medievals are these religious people, and by the way, antiquity also. They subject themselves to God. They pray. And then come the moderns and will say, come on, get up! What are you doing there in that church? You're reasonable human beings. Be autonomous and throw that religious superstition away. Okay, fine. What is the result of that, though? That we're free? Or that we have now, as part of the world that we use for our ends, are also used for ends? I am offended by the talk about human resources. A few years ago, there was even more, it wasn't much. The University of Dallas had a personnel department, and I was happy to go to the personnel department to collect my paycheck there, etc., and you know, to discuss my health insurance and blah, 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 because I felt that I was a person. So personnel department seemed appropriate. Then they announced it's called human resources. And I went over there and said, well, I'm a little bit sad. I thought I was more than a resource. And they said, no, we use this in order to emphasize the importance of our human capital. And I thought, oh dear, now I'm just money. But on the one hand it's funny, on the other hand it's extremely sad, because that's what we've done to ourselves. We think we're the masters of the world, and we're in charge of everything. We are putting our stamp on everything. But then, instead of being these new gods who are in charge of everything, we end up being completely enslaved. Have you seen the photo of Prince when he had a dispute with his recording company, and on his cheek he wrote slave? Anyone seen that? That's who we are. We are slaves. We are slaves to an economic system for which we are nothing but human resource. And it's only the rarest people who are capable of escaping from that. Artists, eccentric types, not even philosophy professors. I teach at a university and, you know, students pay tuition, they see it as a business. So I provide a service for which the university gets paid tuition. And so I'm a service provider. And the student, it's appalling. You go to the website of many universities. What is the library user? The customer. The library user is not a customer. The library user is a library user who wants to read some books. But within this paradigm, the library user is a customer. And I provide a service by giving courses. So you can think, for example, you know, I like being a philosophy professor, then I stand outside and I'm this person who is not implicated in this horrible economic order. No, that's an illusion. Really, most of us are, and of course the interesting thing is even artists get drawn into it. Here's a really eccentric rapper, let's say. You know, who makes this rap music criticizing the police or something, kill the police, and everybody's struck. Next thing you know is 50 copies of this in Walmart. The person has been made into a part of the economic system. We have an economic system which is so powerful it pulls everything in. Don't know if it's possible anymore. The church, I don't know if you, you know, some of you may be active, others not. If you, let's say a Catholic parish, it's all about bookkeeping. Helping Father with the bookkeeping. And making sure there's revenue as Father tries to renovate the church. It's kind of sad, but it's encroaching everywhere. What's a bishop? A fundraiser. A bishop's a fundraiser. That's how a bishop even gets judged on. Bishop, how much did you raise? Raised 50 million for this church. Oh, cool, Vatican. Well, it's kind of, it's on the one hand sad, but the best way to deal with sadness is just laugh about it. Otherwise, you just, you know, depressed all the time and you have to be put on Prozac. all right. So now, wow. So now we have these two worlds juxtaposed. A world that is a religious world. And by the way, everything's also not fine in this religious world. The world where God is the creator and we fit into the cosmic order by trying to find our place in it and imitating nature and so forth. I told you a little, again, a story about it. There was oppression in that world. There was religious persecution. So, you know, it's also not just black and white. It was also a difficult world. But it was a different world. Sometimes it's also interesting to remind oneself that the world could be different from what it's now. Doesn't necessarily mean you want to bring it back, but it was different. And then we have this contemporary world where there really is no God. Now we'd say, but I believe in God. Okay, in a certain sense that doesn't even matter. Because as far as social structures are concerned, the God is money. You can go to church. Does that matter as far as the functioning of society is concerned? It does not. So this order has replaced the older order with unforeseen results. The results are that we haven't liberated ourselves as the Enlightenment thought we would and hoped we would and so forth, but we've enslaved ourselves perhaps in a different way. So, now what is the consequence of that for words? Well, given what I said, you will not be surprised that just as the world has fallen prey to economic interests, so have words. Again, you know, I'm using this precedent, so I have to. I find it fascinating how close they are in English. They're very, very close. So what happens to the world happens to words. So perhaps there's some wisdom in Heraclitus or even in Scripture, when Scripture says that in the beginning was the Word. And Word made the world. Perhaps they're actually very closely connected. So what has happened to the world is the subjection of everything to greed, to economic interests. So that has happened to words too, not surprisingly. So what are words now? Commodities. They're commodities. As a funny story, I looked this, I was on the internet just a few hours ago to get some examples for my talk. And here's a really funny one. Funny. You know Zazzle? Zazzle is that website where you can order, it's actually very nice. I'm not a Zazzle agent. But for example, you can make your own Christmas cards there and have them really professionally printed with your own images, etc., etc. It's kind of nice. One person, but I can't show it here now, had made this beautiful painting. What is it, tacky? Well, is it a dog or is it a fox stepping through some kind of frame against the background of some, you know, beautiful landscape? And at the top of this frame, which looks kind of baroque, it says, "Life is good." Okay. This individual sends this to Zazzle to have his 100 cards printed. And Zazzle says, "Thank you for your email to Zazzle.com. You are a valued customer." We would love to offer every design that our users submit. However, we must abide by all applicable laws and standards, as well as our own content guidelines and copyright policies. Unfortunately, your product was removed because it featured a design that does not meet Zezel's acceptable content guidelines. Specifically, your product contained a copyright-protected text, "Life is good." I checked this out. Life is Good is a brand of women's clothes. So, now, if you want to say life is good, which is a fairly basic statement, you're infringing copyright. Well, it's kind of pathetic. McDonald's holds the copyright to the phrase, "Hey, it could happen." Because about 20 years or so ago, they used that in their stores. They gave out little plastic toys. And the advertisement that ran with the little plastic toys was that the kid goes into the McDonald's, orders the Maxi Burger, and gets a plastic toy. And so Mac, or whoever the guy is, said, "Hey, it could happen." And this one was copyrighted. So if I now, you know, want to make a poem called "Hey, it could happen," McDonald's is going to sue me for an infraction of copyright. So it's interesting. Plagiarism. Plagiarism is precisely this idea, because it goes hand in hand with copyright laws. I have an idea, it's my idea, to which I have to cling to defend my property rights. Because property rights mean that I can generate income from this. I made this wonderful poem, and the poem is not just a wonderful poem. Let's say, well, I mean, I made a wonderful CD. And of course, I don't want everyone to copy the song, but rather I want royalties on the song that I put on the CD. That's the copyright idea. So we now live in this world in which we don't even own the words anymore that we speak. The words are owned by economic interests. And that's why I'm opposed to copyright laws, and why I think that accusations of plagiarism have to be used very, very carefully. Now, I don't want my student to download an essay from the internet. That's not what I'm saying. But I don't constantly want to go on and on to my students how original they have to be, and that they must not borrow from anyone else because their ideas have to be completely their own, blah, blah, blah. Because I know this is nonsense. So, one final thought. Has anyone seen the movie Food Incorporated? It's interesting. One aspect of the movie is that you see copywriting and patenting. Do you know that you can now patent, now if I wanted to put it in religious terms, you can patent parts of God's creation? Monsanto, just purchased by the German corporation Bayer, Monsanto patents particular types of seeds that are engineered, biologically engineered, to withstand herbicides. So you can, let's say, have corn that is resistant to Roundup, is actually what the herbicide is called, so that the farmer can, you know, use this particular type of corn, roll over it twice a year with the herbicide, and only the grasses and weeds, etc., will be killed. The corn will survive. That corn is patented. What does that mean for the farmer? The farmer harvests the corn at the end of the year, sells the corn, and typically the farmer would hold back a certain amount of corn to use it as seed for next year. But that's an infringement of Monsanto's patent. The farmer has to buy the seeds for next year from Monsanto. Nature is now owned by that corporation. So first of all, is that not completely absurd? And also, by the way, where is this going to go? Are we going to be at a point in 100 years where some corporation is going to say, "I own that baby"? Because we developed some medical product with which the embryo was treated, and now as the embryo is born, it's not the mother's, it's actually mine, the corporation's. It could happen. I would not be surprised if something like that were to happen. So it's, you know, the kind of future, if we embrace this new conception of ownership of world and words, the future could be quite dystopian. That was my little talk. you very much for your interest. I always enjoy sharing philosophical ideas.
Okay, we're going to have a little Q&A for the professor.
You've got to turn on. Push the button until it turns green. There you go. You got it.
Is it on?
Yeah. Yes, it's on.
And I'd like to ask the first question. As you indicated, you know, words affect the way we think, the way we see the world. And unfortunately, the meanings of words can be manipulated and changed by political regimes sometimes. Dr. Goebbels and others make up words and change their meanings. 1984, you know, George Orwell, Newspeak, you know.
Sure.
What does security mean? What does democracy mean? What does, you know, freedom mean? So why don't you, you know, what is your idea about, you know, how we think because of words and how this affects the way our psychology is?
Well, I mean, you already are referring to what has happened to the language that we speak. The language that we speak is no longer really, let's put it like this, no longer really grows out of the world in which we live and is no longer really in touch with the tradition, but artificially puts words of such in order to what, really? I have to think as I, it's a difficult question. I'll give you one example of what I'm trying to talk about because I don't think it's clear. When I moved here to the United States 20 years ago, I moved to Irving first and lived in an apartment close to the university. My telephone provider at the time was a company called GTE. General Telephone and Electricity, GTE. GTE indicates what the company was actually doing. It put phones in homes, and the phones had an electric current. And perhaps early on, they also made light bulbs. Who knows? Then, about 5 years after I, you know, started paying the invoices of GTE, they called themselves Verizon. What is that Verizon? So first of all, you've uprooted the corporation from its history. Because someone 100 years ago, whatever, called it GTE. Now you're calling it an artificial name which means nothing, only suggests something vaguely. Verizon, you see, in Latin, truth is veritas. So there is something about truth in there. So the truth, you speak on the phone? It's completely artificial. You know what the corporation does with that? It can now invest in anything. That is to say, it's no longer a corporation that does anything specific, but they become entrepreneurial. Colleagues at the University of Dallas teach entrepreneurship, and I make fun of them for doing that. Because what's an entrepreneur? He or she is not a businessman. A businessman is someone who learns a trade or a business, and it can be really anything. Anything from medicine, law, to banking. And the person makes banking his or her life and becomes a banker. To such an extent, have you ever seen these photos of cartoons from London that the bankers were wearing the funny bowler hat and or wearing one particular type of suit? Their personality was banker. What is an entrepreneur? The entrepreneur is not a lawyer or a doctor or a banker or a telecommunications expert, but someone who puts his or her money wherever it's most profitable. For that purpose, to call a corporation GTE is highly counterproductive. Because it says General Telecommunications and Electricity. What if you want to make medical devices? Well, you can't do it with that label. So you call it Verizon. Verizon could be a book publisher. It could be a dermatology clinic. Well, why not? You know, why not Verizon? You know, I got my acne treatment at Verizon. You say, oh, was it good? So what we're doing with words is that we are, what actually is it? We're making a parallel world according to our own conceptions that obeys only economic interests. And the words we end up speaking are these horrible cliches. One of my colleagues, again, I don't want to go on and on about, because I mean, there's obviously dignified business. One of my colleagues is teaching a class at the moment, you know, English writing and speaking and so forth for businessmen. And then what she has to deal with. You know, in this business, you know, our mission statement is to satisfy the customer at a world-class level so as to, and it's all, you read it and you know it means nothing. It means just absolutely nothing. And so we're increasingly forced to express ourselves in these words that mean nothing, and we know it. Which, by the way, also has a very, which has the effect, by the way, that we see, I think, that's why many people are so cynical about politics. Because we no longer think that what the politicians are saying means anything.
Right.
It is just words that they've made up to seduce us and mislead us.
Right.
So words have lost their dignity. They are unmoored from any reality. So they speak nonsense and we either are disgusted, as the Irish would say, bring the bucket, or we just laugh. So that's the kind of undermining of language that has occurred in contemporary society. Anyway, yeah.
Questions? I think you agree with this premise, as it didn't really, I don't think, go against the main thesis of your argument, but in terms of your student example, I mean, you would concede that there's a difference in the learning process of a student, you know, putting their own effort into the construction of an essay versus just taking something off the shelf.
Right. My point is only not to overdo the whole plagiarism thing. So I would not, I mean, I even tell my students this. I mean, I'm not asking them to produce an original essay. What? The undergraduates who are teaching a philosopher for the first time are supposed to produce an original essay on that philosopher? What's that supposed to be? Obviously, they're going to read books, consult some websites, and put that together. And that's perfectly fine. For the educational process, pedagogically, all that matters is that thinking goes in. You know, by the way, something really interesting about medieval professors? They often copied each other's textbooks from each other. Professor X wrote a textbook, and Professor Y takes absolutely the same textbook and adds 5 sentences. And now it's Professor Y's textbook. Was it because Professor Y was too lazy? No. Professor Y thought Professor X had done a really fine job. And this idea according to which, but this was Professor X's textbook, this didn't exist. So Professor Y just used X's textbook. And it wasn't plagiarism. And you see, the important thing is Professor Y thought about this. So similarly, let's say a student gives me an essay that has a long quotation that's not identified. I would actually draw attention to that. But I would say the crucial thing is, did the student read that quotation, think it through, and on that basis make it part of his or her essay, in which case I would say, fine. Or did the student copy the quotation because he or she was too lazy to write an essay? Well, that's different. Mm-hmm.
My wife was one of the writing teachers you spoke of early in your lecture, 40 years or so teaching writing. And the last 10 or so of it, her students submitted their writing online through a filter. I forget exactly what the name of the software was, but what it would do was it would put on her screen their essay,
mm-hmm.
and in red were all of the plagiarized sentences.
Sure.
And she basically chose whether to accept it, whether it was more black or more red.
Yeah.
Students had a lot of trouble with, you know, who am I, a 19-year-old kid, to have an original idea?
Right.
And what does that mean? And it was
right.
Hard for her to instruct the students. You don't have to have an original idea. You just have to say it in an original way. Well,
you have to think.
That's a pretty subtle distinction.
You have to think through it and make it your own.
Yes.
That's really what it's about.
That's what it's about.
Yeah. By the way, but another thing about plagiarism, some of you are perhaps college students, what I also don't like about plagiarism, if you run essays through this software, which we also do, I don't do it myself because I don't take online essays. See how old-fashioned I am, actually have to give me a printed out essay. So, the atmosphere in the classroom is one of suspicion. You're giving me an essay and I'm already running it through the software because you're probably deceiving me. But that's not very nice. class? I mean, what kind of classroom atmosphere is that? I mean, my assumption in the classroom is everyone's an honorable person. Now, I'm not stupid. One or two of these may not be an honorable person. But for that reason, I cannot assume that everyone is a criminal.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, Donald Trump's wife, who comes, her first language was, I guess, it was either Slovenian or Croatian, one of the two, I'm not.
Oh, she copied the Obama, the Michelle Obama speech.
And what was interesting about the speech was she said, and when I was growing up, my parents taught me. So basically, she's lying about what her parents told her, which I thought that was the worst part, because she's saying, you know, like my, now, in our culture, they'll say, well, my father used to always tell me this. Well, he may have never told him that. He's using that as a crutch.
Right.
But so where do you come down on I've got Ivanka's the daughter. I'm sure, what's the wife's name?
Melania.
Okay. Yeah. Melania. Maybe you give more compensation if the woman is beautiful and a supermodel, or is it?
What about compensation?
No, I'm being facetious. I'm being facetious.
Right.
Are you overlooking if depending on who it is or what? And I will say many of the quotes that we have are, you go back something, let's say that Lincoln said or Benjamin Franklin said, you can find it quoted where they got it from some other saying. Well, I was going to give Ronald Reagan said, I believe he said, there's an old Russian proverb, trust but verify. Basically, maybe that should be your expression in your class. Trust but verify. So you should not feel bad if you run it through the computer. Ronald Reagan checked it. Apparently, though, he was not the first that quoted that, and I don't even know if it was an old Russian proverb or whatever. But,
right.
So,
I mean, that's of course, so let me, I think you asked two distinct points. One, the more theoretical, and since I'm a philosopher, I can answer that relatively easily. Then the more practical one, I'm a philosopher, don't forget, so practical things not so strong on. The first is, well, often quotations have a long history, which means that they're deeply embedded in our culture and are certainly not plagiarism, but become part of the stuff that we're made of. I mean, I'll give you an example. I have a discussion with someone who tells me, you shouldn't have insisted that he pay the last $5 of that bill that you sent him. And I would say, I'm not going to turn the other cheek. Well, where does that come from, turning the other cheek? It's the Sermon on the Mount. Now, have I plagiarized scripture by saying this? No. It's just, in the Western tradition, some things, scripture, Shakespeare, other things, have become what we are. So we often will use expressions. It's a question of to be or not to be. Well, you know, where does that come from? Am I plagiarizing this? Or has that become so much part of the culture in which we live that we constantly think in those terms? That's the one thing I would say. The other thing is the more practical question. So Melania Trump copies portions of Michelle Obama's speech. The question is really, so was the Trump team not able to come up with their own thoughts? It's a little sad. So they, you know, that's the reaction I have to that. So Melania Trump has a life, so she can surely talk about her life. She doesn't have to look at Michelle Obama's life to have a life. So that's what bothers me a little bit about that.
You mentioned the dignity of words, and that's the way I see it. I almost see language as the precious living thing, and we're just the bugs eating away at it, or something like that. And language is the next level of nature, I guess. And I'm amazed that the drug companies, they come up with these words like Abilify and Wellbutrin. And it's just amazing. They must sit around and put these fused words together, and they're really good at taking away the dignity of words.
Yes, they are.
As well as us.
Yes, they are. Yes.
Librium. Librium. That's
And that goes back to the
16th. I think there's a person who wants to ask a question.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, he was behind you.
Oh, no.
Sorry, I agree with you on the pharmacy tech, and some of those words are very hard to pronounce. I think you already managed to have a few disagreements with what you were talking about. The one that's been bugging me the most is word and world. You use that to make an argument that, use that to reinforce your argument. And in reality, it really doesn't. I mean, that's just happenstance that those two are together. So I don't think that's a good idea to use that as evidence that what else you're saying about it is true. But also, when you're talking about argumentation nature, a car being like a horse, a cave, a house being like a cave, that's not necessarily true. You could come up with the idea of a car, four wheels, without in absence of a horse, because you could discover that four wheels balance it better than two. So I don't really think that Descartes atheist, I believe, was natural. I don't think that our ideas come from a higher power. I think we do get our ideas from what's around us, but we can also come up with the original ideas. I also disagree that it's, I don't think we should make the assumption that we can't come up with anything that isn't natural. I think we should just say, hey, we can possibly come up with something better than what's around us. That horse got to being four legs, running really fast, because it all to be that way. It evolved to live better than its environment.
Is there a question?
Not really. A few grievances, I call it.
The grievances are fine. The question is, what's the criterion for the truth of a philosophy? And I happen to think the philosophy is truer that tells you the better story. I have given up the idea according to which philosophy can be proven like a piece of natural science. I think one of the fundamental insights of philosophy is how little we know. Given the fact how little we know, what is philosophy about? It's not about making up stuff. It's about, on the basis of our experience of the world, telling the best story of what the world is like. And if that story really seems to make sense and works well, then that's the philosophy to which I'm going to subscribe. And the story where science and the economy and technology determine what we do is not a story that I think is healthy. And therefore, I reject the story. Your question reminds me of something. Years and years ago, I applied for a job in England at the University of Reading. I don't even know why they invited me, because it's a very different philosophical atmosphere. I give my little talk, and the colleague is very respectful and very British and says, Oh, Dr. Resman, thank you very much for this extremely fine talk. But what you gave us is really poetry, isn't it? That was, now, of course, men were not going to hire you. That's what was said. But I said, yeah, right. I said, yeah, thank you. that's the answer I'm giving you.
Well, wouldn't your philosophy be subjective then to you? I mean, ever try to determine...
No, I'm sharing it with lots of people, and I can see if it makes sense to them, if it helps them in their lives, if it makes sense of the world in which they live, if it allows us to lead better lives.
I'm kind of more interested in knowing more about, you touched base towards the end where words are being patented, like branded pretty much, and you're against that. So what suggestions do you have for me, who's younger, to kind of live in a world where we don't go towards that direction? Does that make sense?
Sure, it makes sense. Oh, sorry, I gosh, I don't know how to, you know, it's difficult. It's a very, very, very difficult question. A couple of years ago, sorry for telling you stories as though I were 90 years old. I'm not, I'm just 52. But I like telling stories. So a couple of years ago, I had the honor, it was a great honor, of being invited to speak at a university in Mexico, Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México. The student listened to me, although I couldn't speak Spanish, I spoke English, and they were very enthusiastic. But of course, Mexico has its own set of problems, very, very significant ones. And so their questions became more practical towards the end. I said, how do you think we should deal with this situation? You know, the Mexicans think different politically. They have a history of revolutions. And so I simply said, revolución. And they said, right. And I could see the reaction on their faces. Right, right, revolution. So, you know, I mean, we're at a point where some revolutionary thinking is necessary. And I'm not saying assassinate the president. That's not the message. But vote for the same old political parties. You know, they're not just doing the same thing, not moving us forward. Perhaps some new thinking has to occur. Perhaps these are not the only ways in which the country can develop. Perhaps there are some other possibilities. One problem, really, in the United States, I'm an American citizen, so this is not anti-American. I have two passports, German and American. You know what's different between Europe and America? A few things. I mean, it's a different continent to begin with, some other differences. In Europe, the political party system has become more diverse. I'll give you one example. Germany, France, these countries have large green parties, environmentalist parties. So questions that here are still at the margins of society, for example, should we pollute the air completely? Well, in Europe, that's not even asked anymore. Of course we shouldn't pollute the air completely. We want to breathe clean air. Here we have these two completely monolithic political blocks, and many people say it's really just one party that has two extensions, because there's really no alternative. They're just doing, whoever you vote for, they're going to do the same thing. So why couldn't there be a party system that had some different voices? For example, no, it is becoming political, and if I annoy some of you, then contradict me, you know, then we'll have a discussion. I don't, you know, have to be the one who dominates everything here. But that's what I liked about Bernie Sanders. It was a different voice. It was different. So, now you're going to say this is horrible. But, you know, sorry about that, you know, that I expressed my own political views. Again, you know, I don't want to. So, but that's what I'm thinking. What if there were a third party? Not just these two, but a third party that really was thinking about what America could be and become differently. That's what we need. And of course, you know, why don't young people do it? Right?
you had mentioned earlier, you quoted our Python Prince image with him riding a slave on there in reference to him being a slave to his record company.
Right.
But he was also notorious about keeping his own songs to himself and not letting anybody else release them, either for monetary or for artistic reasons.
Right.
You seem to believe that the concept of ownership of a song is something that's unique to capitalism or consumerism or whatever else, and is not an inherent artistic trait in people in general. And that you seem to be blaming capitalism, if nothing else, on for these problems as opposed to an inherent human ownership and survival and everything else involved in that. Do you have any thoughts?
Yes, I do. As with everything, it's about balance. So should Prince or anyone make music and then just release it completely for free? No. Perhaps in an ideal world, yes. But does the musician want to have some income? Yes. So, fine that Prince, you know, didn't, you know, put all his songs in the public domain, etc., etc. The question is always one of degree. I mean, how stringent do we get with copyrights and with patents and so forth? It's about finding a balance. Similarly, with regard to capitalism, again, sorry, I mean, I certainly don't want to just annoy you with my own views. The problem with capitalism is perhaps not capitalism as such, but the fact that it's gotten completely out of control. You know, do we want to live in a socialism or something? Probably not. But this kind of hyper-capitalism, where really there's nothing that doesn't have an economic value that escapes from that economic machine, that's not good. And so perhaps what we need is a capitalism that's a bit tamed, that has a human face to it.
They want us to get out of here before 9 o'clock. So one more question, anybody? If nobody, then I would like to add just one little thing, ask you one little thing. You know, in our present politically correct society, I don't know about Europe, but in America, we change things like there are no waiters and waitresses, there are food servers. There are no stewardesses, there are airline attendants. There are no doctors, there's health care providers. What are lawyers going to be? Legal word pushers? words kind of are decolorizing, dehumanizing a society. I mean, they're not colorful, they're not human anymore.
They aren't. I think that's right. I mean, what can I say about that? Typically, you know, these terms become more technocratic. So, I mean, who is a doctor? A doctor is the person I see when I feel sick, hoping for some advice and possibly help. What's a healthcare provider?
Yeah.
You know, a healthcare provider is that element of some, you know, who enjoys going to a doctor and a hospital? No one, because you feel that you're immediately dehumanized. And that's not because the doctor is also being dehumanized. It's not that the doctor wants to dehumanize you. It's that the doctor is forced to work in a system where he has to see you in 10 minutes. They have to put these masses of people through there. And so everyone gets a dehumanizing word attached. And it comes from this tendency to make everything more technocratic. And of course, to subject everything to economic profit. You know, Plato has a wonderful story. It's really wonderful. Plato is also quite cool. Plato has this story about doctors. He says, a doctor who earns money has two professions, a doctor and a wage earner. And the two professions are different. Because the doctor has only the obligation to implement and obey the discipline of medicine as best he can. That's what he does, and then if it pays, that's fine, he takes the money. And he has to live, blah, blah, blah. And you can say that about any profession that has any dignity to it. I'm a philosophy professor and I get paid. But I don't teach students because I get paid. That's kind of really crude. So I'm only teaching these students because the university is sending some money to my account. I mean, what kind of human being does that make? No, I teach the students because I love philosophy and I want to help these students out with some ideas. And because I'm human and I have a house to pay for with, you know, a mortgage and blah, 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 the university is nice enough to put some money into my account. But I think it's very important to keep these distinct. And what we increasingly do is, why are you a doctor? Because I want to be rich. Why are you a banker? And you could say, I love these financial transactions at the stock market. Wow, that's so interesting. No, honestly, there are people like that. And if somebody like that talks to me and says he's a banker because he finds that, I would say, head off, wonderful, and you're rich, excellent. But if somebody tells me, why do you want to be a banker? I want to be rich. Sorry. That's all you want to be. That's a bit sad.